Imagine you've done 4 months of rehearsing with Michael Jackson for the final This Is It tour. He bids the band farewell after the rehearsal finishes at 12:30 a.m. and within hours, he's passed away. Fast forward 2 weeks, at the same venue, on the same stage, as the world watches on, you look down and you notice your left hand is shaking as you're about to play the intro to Man in the Mirror to accompany the members of the Jackson 5 to carry their brother's coffin off stage for the final time. That was our reality for the guest today. Welcome to the Stage Dave Podcast. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes from working with the likes of Beyonce, Guns N' Roses, Elvis Presley, David Bowie, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Queen, Nick Cave, Oasis, The 1975, Bob Dylan, John Mayer and Kraftwerk. Today we are joined by composer, producer and multi-instrumentalist Mo Pleasure, who was Michael Jackson's bandmate in the This Is It tour that never happened and spent 8 years as musical director for Grammy Hall of Famers Earth, Wind & Fire. Today we'll be discussing how musicians can thrive in high-pressure environments, what it was like playing with Ray Charles at the Royal Festival Hall, what Mo learned from working with MJ at such close proximity, and how to overcome challenges in a live and recording setting. As someone whose first ever concert was Michael Jackson's Bad Tour, and as someone who had tickets for the This Is It shows, this is going to be a special episode for me. So welcome to the boogie wonderland that is Mo Pleasure. Thanks for joining us today, Mo. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great, Chris. I'm so happy to be here.
Good stuff. Yeah. Thank you. And we're in London, and how are you finding, living in London on this kind of damp, cold, overcast August day in the height of our summer?
So used to it, Chris. I'm telling you, I've actually been here now about 4 years, on and off before. I was kind of back and forth a lot more to the States, but now I'm kind of sticking it out. So I've been through a few winters and summers and the whole lot, so I'm used to it.
And you were born in Hartford in Connecticut, is
that
right?
Absolutely true.
Now,
yes.
We've got listeners on every continent, and many of them won't have been to Connecticut, so can you paint a picture of what Connecticut was like growing up and how it compares to now in Connecticut?
It's pretty much, if I go back to my hometown, which is Guilford, Connecticut, actually, where I grew up, it's pretty much the same place that I left, and it was a beautiful place with great people, very kind of liberal community, a lot of arts. It's on the shoreline, so we had the beach, and
nice.
I'm kind of a water freak and all that, and it was great because my dad was a principal of one of the schools there, and he's long passed away since, but very respected man. When I go there, we're kind of still royalty. And the funny thing about it, yeah, it's great. The funny thing about it was that, we were a black family that moved there in 1969, and it's a completely white town. Mm-hmm. There were probably four black families when I grew up, and there are probably still about four black families there now.
Yeah.
Or other, ethnicities and stuff. But the people, it never felt that way because the people were so welcoming and so, really about about people as opposed to, race or anything like that. So,
and your dad being a principal, was he happy that you went into being a musician, or was he someone who wanted you to have a inverted commas proper job?
A little bit of both, Chris, because he actually was a musician himself.
Oh,
he was
right.
An incredible singer, never professionally, but very much so much, in the community and at his schools, mm-hmm. that he would always be singing with the choir, whatever the school groups were, and also with the church and stuff.
You went to Louisiana quite a lot and experienced some quite firsthand inequalities in regards to segregation. And I believe back then, was it a case that if you were a black family traveling through some of those areas, you couldn't stay at some of the hotels?
That's absolutely true, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
At what stage of your life did you realize how wrong that was?
Well, even back then, because the reason I was going to Louisiana a lot is because my grandparents were there. So my mother and father are from Louisiana, mm-hmm. Which is down in the south. And so I would go down there and we would be, I'd be asking my grandfather why we couldn't, drink from this water fountain or go to this pool and this kind of thing, because I had white and colored back then, I'd say colored.
What was his response to that? When you asked him, did he lie or did he actually say?
No, there was no way to lie about it. It was just absolutely true, that segregation, we called it Jim Crow, existed, and that's just the way it was. It was a white side of town, black side of town, this whole thing, white recreation center. you know, black recreation. Everything was split that way, and still is. I mean, it's the actual laws have changed, but the actual my mother still lives there in Louisiana, kind of in the in a small town. And if I go down there now, it really hasn't changed much at all.
That was my next question: how has America changed, and has it changed enough for you?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, yes, it's changed, and yes, it hasn't, you know. As we're learning now, we're having a lot of problems with race and, you know, kind of just division and all that kind of stuff. And I've always felt it, you know, because I've been in the world. You know, I actually, obviously, been around the world quite a few times, and back to the States and all that. So I have noticed, you know, not only the changes in the States, but how we're regarded in the States by other countries and people around the world. So it's a little bit of a trying time right now, but I think we kind of had to go through it, and I could see it coming for a long time.
Well, London welcomes you with open arms, and you would have been based here, I'm guessing, for the This Is It shows, because it was supposed to be at the O2. How far down the line were you? I mean, had, like, your accommodation been agreed? Did you know where you'd be staying and stuff like that? Or
yes, we had, like, they told us what our apartments were going to be, and you know, we were, like, trying to figure out, like, because, you know, we were getting a lot of endorsements from companies, so I was saying, you know, I'm going to have these kind of speakers in my, you know, in my studio and this and that, and companies were willing to give us this. And the cool thing about it was going to be such that we could play a show and literally, boom, play the last note, and I could get on a tube and be at my apartment in, like, 10 minutes without even going to the dressing room, you know. So it was going to be a very easy thing, you know, back and forth to the O2. We were all excited about it. And it was like, basically 9 days before we were supposed to come to the UK when Michael died.
Yeah, and so how ready were you from the kind of concert experience point of view? I mean, if you'd had a concert 3 days later, do you think you could have nailed it, or was there still bits and pieces you need to put together?
Oh, no, we were so confident. We knew we had something really special. It felt like, at the time, it felt like, you know, Michael was pretty much ready, and we had a pretty, you know, non-intensive schedule while we were here. I mean, I think it was 3 nights a week or something like that, and there was lots of hiatus time, you know, where we weren't actually playing. So it was a cool thing. And, you know, and also in this industry, having a job for a couple of years that you could kind of just, you know, rely on was a great feeling as well, you know. So
from a musician's point of view, you know, there's a business that you've got, your own business, and what you're doing with this, like, do you get compensated in that kind of thing? Like, or did you just, you know, you get, I guess you got paid for the rehearsals. Like, that's such a difficult situation to experience. You know, you signed up probably for a couple of years. So
we did, and it was supposed to be even more after that, we were told by, you know, by management and so on. But matter of fact, it was devastating because we were let off in the middle of the summer without a gig, and we were paid rehearsal pay and nothing else by AEG. And then the movie came out as well, and we weren't paid for the movie either.
Really?
Yeah, we weren't paid for the movie. And that's something that, you know, I don't like talk about a lot, but it's absolutely true. We were actually left with no money, and we were left with no job in the middle of the summer.
Wow. So I had tickets for that show. So you remember there was supposed to be 10 shows at the beginning, and then it kind of got extended to 50 shows. And I had tickets for I think it was the second, third night when for the first 10, which in the end would have been bolted on to the end, I think it was, because things got delayed. But, you know, it was billed as kind of an entirely new concert experience. Mo, tell me what I would have experienced.
Well, the thing about it was, you know, even if you look at the movie, This Is It, there were things in it that we hadn't even experienced. There were some gags, as we call them, some tricks, and you know, at the end, I couldn't wait to see Michael leave on a jet plane. You know,
was that what was going to happen? What was the last image? He was going to go on a jet plane.
But we had a airplane that was up on the video screen that had a place for Michael to climb the stairs, probably wave to everybody, and then get in it. And however they were going to do it, it was going to actually be some type of, I don't know, hologram experience or whatever, to for him flying a jet plane over the audience to get out or something like that. And there were some other things as well. In Earth Song, I remember there was going to be a giant bulldozer.
It comes out on the stage.
Sure.
Yeah.
So there were a few gags and things that we hadn't really done yet. But other than that, the show was, like, put together. Yeah. Which took a while. We have to learn all the songs in different keys, you know.
That's interesting. You know, what, in case he wanted to change the key on the night? Okay, cool.
Yeah, and he had to, and that, it may not seem like a big thing, but in terms of just actually, you know, not just knowing the songs, but having all the, you know, as a keyboard player, having all our splits, all keyboard players know what that is. Like, say on one keyboard, you have more than one sound. All that changes when you change the key, because then where the split points are different, and you have to remember them all in your head. Even different guitars, because something like Beat It, if the key was too low, then all the strings would just be floppy, right. You know. Yeah, so yeah. They had to build actually guitars for the different keys and that kind of thing. So there was a lot of preparation. By the time Michael unfortunately passed away, we were so ready for the show. Like he could have just
set any key
on any song, change the order, whatever, and we were ready.
And is it true that F sharp is the worst key?
Still, absolutely. Yeah, Chris.
There we go. So hopefully you would have avoided that for you. About young musicians listen to this, a lot of them will have similar experiences to bands on stage, but not many, you know, at that kind of amateur level, if you like playing pubs and gigs and that kind of thing, sure. Will have a musical director. So I wonder, could you break down what the musical director's role is? Because you did it at Earth, Wind and Fire.
Yep.
And where the, if you like, not the power lies, but there was an interest. I watched This Is It the other night, two nights ago, preparation for this. And was it Michael Bearden?
Michael Bearden, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And there was an interesting bit where he kind of challenged MJ a little bit, I felt, on kind of that he maybe should have been at the rehearsals and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and MJ was like, well, just learn what's on the record. And he said, yeah, but I need your... And I just wonder where the, not the power lies, but who has the final say in that situation?
Well, you know, I found that it's kind of a, you know, it's a team effort, of course, but there's also, like, because as a musical director, you're kind of... definitely your first line of business is to make the artist happy and create what it is that they're trying to, you know, put forth to the people. But at the same time, you have to not just communicate that to a band or whatever, but you also have to deal with a lot of personalities in the band as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of it's psychology and how do I talk to this person if I'm dealing with like an Earth, Wind & Fire. That's the artist actually was three of members. The rest of us were basically side men of sorts, you know. But it's different than, like, now I'm Bette Midler's music director, so I'm dealing with Bette. And, you know, we'll start out with 61 songs and try every key and tempo and all that, and we're whittling it down to about 20, 25 songs for a show. And as the show is progressing, we're always changing things as well. So I think it's the kind of thing that, like, you really get a serious relationship with the artist, and you know, you learn how to work together. So there's a lot of times if I think that something is really important, that I'll, you know, challenge an artist, and sometimes I win, sometimes I don't. Mm-hmm. I'm always open to interpretations from the band about what they think is best to do, but I just think that as a music director, that one of the main things that they want is confidence, so that, you know, if there's going to be a change or something's going on, then you're and I mean, sometimes at the moment, you know, you might be in the middle of a show and something changes, you're the captain of the ship and you have to be very decisive. And even if you're wrong, you have to exude confidence so that everybody goes along with, you know, what you're saying.
And who's accountable for finding sounds? So you played keyboard on... I think you did the intro to Man in the Mirror. Is that right?
It's true. Dun, 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 dun. I did.
Right. So that's recorded 30 years ago, 35 years ago. Where do you find those exact sounds so you can play those parts again? And who's accountable? Yeah. Is that the music director? Is it the individual? Or is it someone else?
Well, we have some really great keyboard programmers with us, you know. So there's always that. So and then, you know, I do a little bit myself. So if you can get yourself kind of in the ballpark of what the sounds are, then it's all tweaking.
Is it?
Know?
Right.
And you've got, you know, say you're working a month on, you know, in a rehearsal before we even get to production rehearsal. By the time you get it together, all the levels and all the sounds are tweaked in, and your front of house engineer and monitor engineers know exactly, you know, like they'll stay in a room with some near field monitors while you're doing rehearsal every day, and then as you stop and you're going to have a sandwich or go eat or something, and here comes the engineer saying, hey, can you bring down that bell sound, you know, 2 dB? And so it's like, you know, by the time you actually get to the point of playing, it's been well tweaked, you know.
And you were credited on that, on This Is It shows, as playing keys, trumpets, and guitar. What did you play on it? Can you pick out, what did you particular play? Was there a particular part you liked playing or highlight that you were at the fore?
Yeah, well, I did, you know, I played keyboards on most of it. So it was like I had four keyboards and, you know, a lot of splits on those, all the pedals for, you know, volume and sustain and all that kind of stuff. And there were two of us. So Michael Bearden was on the other side, and we covered a lot. Then we also had Bashiri Johnson doing percussion, and he had a lot of electronic percussion. He was playing with his hands and his feet. So, you know, you'd see him and he looked like he was running or jogging or sometimes, and he was actually doing like maybe hand claps with his feet, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Then we had Sugarfoot Moffitt on the drums, and he had a lot of triggers as well. So all together we were able to cover, you know.
And what happens if it's the first night of the tour and Michael Bearden falls ill and he can't make it because he's really unwell? What would have happened on that kind of...
Well, we would probably be trying to like somehow nurse him back to health really quickly, you know.
Let's say he's fallen over and broken or something like that. Oh, he couldn't do his job.
Sure.
Like, is there backup plans or plan Bs and plan Cs those scale shows?
It happened to me. I had to do... I was on Janet Jackson's gig and the other keyboard player had to leave on a day's notice. And I literally had them bring his keyboard rig to my left side, which was identical to my rig. So I knew where all the sounds were and everything. And then next night, you know, I stayed up all night and, you know, kind of choreographed it. A lot of keyboard playing is choreography. Like, you know, how do I play this and this at the same time? And
fine.
How do I switch sounds in time to get to that? And, you know, where are the splits and all that kind of stuff. So I did have to once actually do that. And then I had to cover everything. And then I was the only keyboard player because, you know, they saved the salary.
Yeah.
So,
and what did you play trumpet on?
So trumpet was like, you know, I was playing on jam and that kind of stuff with Michael.
Nice.
Sometimes I would actually play keyboards and trumpet at the same time.
Really?
Yeah. Like, you know, play horn parts on the keyboard.
So one-handed trumpet.
Exactly.
Like that, and the other hand on the keyboard.
Hand on the keyboard. And actually even some of the samples of the horn sounds were me. In addition to the Yamaha sounds in the keyboard, we'd have me sample my horn, a guy named Dave Polich, who was our programmer, and we do a bunch of different things, falls, you know, that kind of thing.
Nice.
And that's me just straight notes and dips and whatever kind of thing. And then he would just integrate them with the sounds that we had. So a lot of times, even what I was playing was me, you know, with on the keyboards was actually me.
You've got the dancers who went through a very extensive audition process.
Oh, yeah.
Was it the same as an audition process? Probably not as physical, I'd imagine.
For the band,
But for the band, like, how did you? What was the audition process? How did
you? You know, I was very lucky because I didn't have to audition at all. I had known Michael Bearden since the '80s, and we were two up-and-coming, you know, keyboardists. And then we'd also done a lot of gigs together, you know, jazz gigs and, you know, just stuff like that. And so it was a situation. It was kind of crazy how I got the gig because they already had a keyboardist, and he wasn't able to do it due to contractual problems with some TV reality show, show,
American
or something.
Idol or something.
Like, I think it was American Idol actually. Right. And
you'd be so gutted about that.
Well. If you think about it, he still had a job.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
But the so it just happened that he after. So I came in about a 3 weeks to a month late to rehearsals, and I had to learn everything kind of quickly, which was easy for me because first of all the sounds were already kind of in place for my keyboards,
nice.
And it was Michael Jackson, so I already knew the songs, you know. So it was great, and I fit right into the band, you know. As far as you know, the band was like very much a family unit. You know, we all were like brothers and sisters working together to, you know, get this thing done. And Michael was such a nice guy. And so, you know, so much about letting us do what we do. That's thus, you know, playing trumpet, and I played acoustic guitar in Black and White and stuff.
Did
like
you?
That.
Yeah. Nice.
So that was, you know, that was my claim to fame on the guitar on that tour. But it was great because, you know, I was kind of a utility man, as we call it, you know, not just keyboards, but other little parts, you know.
And as someone who comes from a bit of a jazz background and loves a bit of jazz, where does spontaneity lie in a show like This Is It, Michael Jackson's? Because it's almost like a theatre show, isn't it? It seemed to me like it's going to be, this is a performance of this song, then it's costume change into the next one. Was there any room for spontaneity in that show, or was it a case that we need to do the same thing every time?
Well, I'll say this, for This Is It, not really. You know, especially as a second keyboardist. But like, I have had other shows like Janet Jackson. If you check out the HBO Live in Hawaii, this was Offer You tour. It was like 2002.
Yeah.
Yep. There were spots that they needed me to actually improvise. For example, there was a spot where Janet needed to change between acts, and they had what they were called the inflatables. I think it was Escapade was a song or something. Like this whole inflatable kind of city would come up, and then gnomes and elves would come out. So they needed probably 2 or 3 minutes for that to happen. But it was a situation where they didn't know exactly how much time they needed. So I would come up with a kind of an orchestral string sound and create something that would fill in that space. And then video would put something on the video screen that would kind of go with it. Matter of fact, we after 9/11... I remember playing, and I went into a song called America the Beautiful.
Right, nice.
So immediately the video team came up with some kind of montage with American flag and this whole kind of thing. So it was all improvised.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Wow.
And then we'd hear in our in-ears, earphones that, okay, Janet's ready, or the thing is ready, and we go right into the next tune.
Wow. So there can be in some of these shows, but not in all of them, I suppose.
And then I also try to put my little bits in. So, you know, if even less on Michael's than Janet's, but on Janet's, you know, I might like put like a little funky piano riff and just see if someone told me not to do it, you know, and then if it stayed, then actually they would be looking for it.
Yeah.
You know, they might even put an extra choreography move to it or something.
Nice. Yeah, yes, can influence it. Great. And with This Is It, you must have had some preconceptions of what MJ would be like. What kind of myths about Michael were kind of debunked from your perspective, having worked with him?
Oh, I was told you couldn't look in his eyes. You know, I was told you never look at him, this kind of thing, or don't speak to him and all that. And he couldn't have been more warm and really, like, I never really had a chance to just like have a full out conversation with him, just a few words here and there, because everything was just moving so fast. He's coming from choreography rehearsal to band rehearsal to CGI stuff to whatever kind of business meetings and all that. But I never felt that it wasn't like I couldn't just talk to the guy, you know, and you know, certainly could look him in the eye. It wasn't a problem, you know. Shook his hand and all that kind of stuff. So.
And with the 50 shows, he could have gone and played 50 shows in every major city in the world. Had you kind of in the back of your head thought, there's going to be more than 50 shows here, we could go and do other things elsewhere? Or were you just planning to do those ones?
No, we were told quietly that they had planned on continuing on after the O2. So whatever that meant, you know, and of course, then maybe that would change once they actually did it, because I've heard different things about, you know, how willing Michael was to be a part of it. But no, it was exciting because I was actually, you know, really looking forward to more than the O2.
Yeah, absolutely. And at what point did you know that it went from kind of 10 gigs to 50? Were you surprised by that, or were you like, you know?
I wasn't a part of that. By the time I got in there, it was 50.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
right.
I already knew that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it was, I mean, it was a great gig to be kind of involved in. It's such a shame it obviously didn't happen.
Yeah.
What lessons were learned from that whole episode, do you think?
Wow, so many, you know. First of all, even now, the way I am about any kind of work, I believe it once I'm on stage doing it, you know, because it's kind of like, well, who would have thought that Michael Jackson would have died, you know? Out of that, we became a lot of notoriety for me, because from having been in the movie and all that. So it's kind of weird that although we didn't actually tour, I still was able to kind of be, a lot of musicians kind of knew who I am and such because of the movie. you know. And we, at the time, that was all just footage that was taken from Michael to his dailies to kind of like check out things, you know, and you know, make changes and all that kind of stuff. We were just used to cameras being around all the time. And then when he died, then they, you know, sold the footage to Sony, and Sony made a movie out of it. But the thing about it was, like, out of all of that terrible, you know, stuff that happened, there it has actually helped my career in some ways too.
If you, Kenny Ortega, embarking on another kind of similar thing going forward, what would you do differently?
Well, now I'm a little bit older, and, you know, and I've kind of experienced the business. I think really it's important to have, you know, really solid business, the contracts and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's one thing. I think you really have to always represent yourself as someone that's, you know, has their business act together. So, you know, sometimes you might be quick to go like, oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, I'm not worried about it. They'll pay me, or, you know, this and that. So, and I've just seen so many things happen that I just couldn't have foreseen. That I just think it's really important to
get it in writing.
Yeah, get it in writing, basically, is what I'm saying.
But that's a difficult conversation to have in that situation. So if you're a sideman musician and you're understandably, you're going to really say, this is such a prospect. Yeah, I'll go along with it. So you want to go. So it's a difficult conversation to start saying, well, actually, can I have that in writing, please?
Yeah, no, it's a very, it's
be
a
like,
weird.
Right, no, get him out the door.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And, you know, and you do take a chance on that, too, whenever you do something like that. So you have to kind of pick your spots, of course. But, you know, at the same time, I think that when you realize that there is an opportunity to, you know, get something in writing or just have some, even if it's an email. You know, it can even be an email. Just protect yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about onstage communication.
Sure.
Because he was kind of very notorious of being, like, great with his cues and that kind of thing. Yeah. He'd stick out his arm and he'd get the band to do it. Sure. So tell us how you learned that process. So I'm a new musician. I've not played with someone who does this kind of thing before on stage. I'm used to playing my stuff. I know what I'm doing. Right. But following these cues, talk me through what I need to be able to do.
Yeah. And with Michael, it was really important because we were doing the sound effects on the keyboards and all that, too.
All that explosions.
So, and, you know, really not just watching him, but also, like say, if he's pointing and explosions on the other side of the stage, there's how much time is it as opposed to the...
As the finger goes
down.
Right,
because there's one point, I think, you know, the dancers were acting kind of the Jackson 5.
Yes,
kind of explosion, that kind of thing. So, like, that, the one that's farthest from, you know, this
has
kind
to
of
be
thing.
A fit further.
Yeah,
wow.
Right. And just stuff like that. But I think I have to attribute my training, not just, like, say, in college and school and all that, but also the Ray Charles gig. We had to follow Ray Charles, like, constantly. And, that taught me, and that was a full big band, you know.
Yeah. I watched a video of it. That was at Royal Festival Hall, just down the road from here. Is that right? Yeah. Wow, cool.
Yeah, that was an orchestra gig, but, like, in general, we would mostly do big band. We had a big band that we...
Yeah.
That one, the Royal Festival gig, there were just three of us.
Wow.
Me, Jeff Pivar, and Paul Krybek, Jeff on guitar and Paul on drums, and we played with orchestra, whereas the rest of the band was waiting in Texas, if I remember. And then we flew right back, and then we were... doing the big man stuff. So
in regards to following him, is it a case that, because today we've spoken to people, so Richard Fortus from Guns N' Roses talks about how there's an on-stage communication system now.
Question.
So he's you know, if they're performing a song, he can kind of put his foot on a pedal and speak through that mic and say, right, we're going to go do another chorus or whatever it might be. I'm guessing that didn't exist when Ray Charles was, you know, playing.
Right.
So how do you...
Well, even with that, you know, like I say Bette Midler, for example, I do have MD, I do have a talkback mic that only the musicians can hear in their in-ears.
Got it.
And also, you know, monitors and everybody involved in, you know, lights and all that kind of stuff. I can talk to anybody.
And there's no way the audience could ever accidentally hear anything.
No, not if we do it right. You know, I have that special, you know, hotline mic. But what I'm talking about more is, like, body movements. And even as a music director, I teach the band my body movements.
Oh.
So I'm like, okay, just watch me. And when I do this, you know,
put that's your what we shoulder cut, down to
totally.
That.
Totally. Or what are my cutoff moves? You know, I do this when it's like that. Or if I'm trying to, if it's not fast enough, you'll see me do this or pull back on that kind of stuff. So Ray actually kind of taught me a lot of that because we were watching his body movements.
That's amazing. Yeah. So it's basically a different language, but it's like a different language. Wow.
And mostly his feet, of all things, because Ray would pull back on tempos and then speed up and, you know, whatever, and also volumes and stuff. He could just raise his hand like this and the whole band would come down to volume because they knew he was about to say, come down, you know. And we knew him so well that by the time we saw his hand just actually start to go up in the air, boom, the whole band would just kind of come down, you know. So, yeah, you can teach it. You can do a lot with your body.
Wow. You know? Yeah, so just learning that language. That's so interesting. That's great. Yeah. Cool. And, I mean, I've got to ask, I mean, how did you find out about MJ passing? I mean, that was such a crazy night for the whole world. I was in, my mum used to live in Spain, and I'd spent, she had an apartment in Spain, and I was going out there for 2 weeks, and I had these tickets for the shows coming up, and I thought, well, you know, 2 weeks, it's going to be lovely staying with her, but, you know, I'm going to be by the pool, it's going to be a bit of a dull, kind of boring time, so what I'll do is I'll get this autobiography of Michael Jackson, which was like 700 pages, it was written by one of his friends, and I spent the whole 2 weeks reading this book, and then kind of over dinner, we were talking about Michael Jackson the whole time, because it was like, oh, he did this, he did this, he did this, it's really interesting. I finish the book, go to bed, and then wake up like 2 hours later and I see all these notifications on my phone. Wow. Saying, check that. And it was the news that he passed. And I had this like emotional investment after reading this whole book. It was so fucked up. And so, I mean, you rehearsed with him the night before, is that right? Or a few hours?
Yeah, we rehearsed. I'll never forget the night. It was, we finished about 12:30 at night. And it was, that day was strange. The day before he died, the strange part was that, and it wasn't that strange, but they moved rehearsal a few hours later, so we were kind of hanging around.
Why? Do you know why they moved it?
We don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, with Michael, that was something that happened a lot because maybe dance rehearsal went long, or it could be anything.
Could be anything,
you know?
Right.
So, you know, we had like a few hours to kind of sit around, and normally those are the times that you're like doing a little extra programming or, you know, going through some parts that you weren't quite sure of and all that, but we were so confident that everybody was, you know, we were like throwing a football around, doing stuff like that, or... and I was, it was something I'll never forget was I was sitting next to Sugarfoot, who's a very good friend of mine. We were sitting on a case, on a road case, and Foot tells me something's wrong. And I'll never forget it. He said something was wrong. He felt that there was something wrong with Michael, and it wasn't the same on Michael. He was normally. I didn't know Michael. Foot knew him for 30 years, so that's a guy that would actually know. He was saying, like, we really need the band to come together and be around him because he's going to need us for support and all this. And I was like, yeah, come on, count on me. I'm there, you know. And then, you know, so the next morning I'm waking up and
did he turn up to that rehearsal in the end and play? Did he do it?
He came in and we did. And it's funny, we actually were going down we were finally got to the point where we got the show down to whatever it was, an hour and 15, 20 minutes, so, which takes a long time to get a show that tight, you know. And we were actually running the show. It was like we were just starting to run like the whole show. We didn't get all the way through it, and then they called rehearsal. And the thing I remember the most was I was walking off the stage with all my stuff. You know, they said, okay, that's it for rehearsal. And I was walking off the stage, and all the dancers were already dressed for the next song, you know, and they were at the bottom of the stairs. They hadn't heard that rehearsal was called, so I kind of, they were like, "What's going on?" You know, I said, "Yeah, they just called rehearsal. We're done." You know, so that's like 12:30 a.m. at night. You know, Michael was in good spirits. I could actually hear Michael in my in-ears backstage sometimes laughing. You know, like talking to somebody. You know, whatever. Yeah. And so I thought everything was fine. Next morning, I wake up, and we actually lost one of our icons. Her name was Farrah Fawcett.
Same morning.
I used to have her poster when I was a little kid and all that. So it was kind of sad. And I was actually packing for rehearsal because maybe we were starting in the afternoon. And people were starting to call me saying they'd heard this and that, you know, about Michael. And I just refused to believe it till I got to the Staples Center. So... when I got there, I could see, because I was thinking maybe, you know, there was always like a TMZ or some gossip, people kind of sneaking into rehearsals and this kind of stuff. I thought maybe maybe there was some kind of rumor going around because he was going to take us somewhere else to rehearse or something like that. Because Michael.
Oh, so you thought it might be a decoy the whole
time? Yeah, I thought it might have been a decoy, you know, like, you just never know with Michael Jackson. And when I got there, I could see all the police tape around, and there was a crime scene and all this, and Yeah, it was a horrible thing to walk into, you know, and people were crying all over the place. And I ran into Sugarfoot, and he just was, you know, lifeless, really, because that was his friend. And, you know, we were signing in to go into Stable Center, and he looked at me, and he was like, remember what I told you yesterday? You know, and I said, yeah. And then that we ended up going to a restaurant and with the band and dancers and the suits, the staff, you know, the management and all that. And we had a dinner together and kind of just told Michael stories about the rehearsal and stuff like that. And I'll sign this big poster of Michael. And it was really, really sad. Next day I was on a flight home.
Did you not have to do the memorial well? So that was in the same venue, is that right?
It was the same venue on the same stage, yes.
And I heard you say that, like, you know, everything was set up as it had been previously, but instead of Michael being there, it was coughing.
Yeah, it was strange.
So heavy, man.
Yeah, it was heavy.
So you had to play the intro to Man in the Mirror.
I did.
Just after Paris Jackson had done a talk, is that right?
Yes.
Which must have been very difficult.
Oh, it was so difficult. I mean, you know, Chris, about as far away as that wall is, that's how close the podium was with you know, everybody that spoke. So when Paris said that, she was like maybe, you know, 20 feet away from me. And then I have to play the bell part for Man in the Mirror. And I've got this, my hand is shaking, literally shaking. And but at the same time, there's a voice in my head saying, don't mess this up, because, you know, you're going to hear about this. About 28 billion people are watching it, or whatever it is. So it was probably the hardest thing I ever had to play in my musical career, was that simple bell part, because that's when they actually picked up the coffin and carried him out.
Sharon, I mean, that's such a difficult thing for you to process. Have you processed it since? You know, have you looked after yourself since? You know, that's a very, you know, Sugarfoot, yes, he was obviously good friends with him, but you work so closely. It's such a massive thing that everybody had to kind of experience. Have you processed that kind of?
Well, you know, it's been a tough one, Chris, because, you know, just emotionally, it was one of those things. That scene, first of all, was very surreal, the whole thing, to be kind of in the eye of the storm of something like that. Then I think as, like, you know, this is it, family. To me, it kind of just, everybody went completely different directions. So it wasn't like we all could kind of rely on each other. And, you know, at least I felt this way. Some of the other band members might feel differently. You know, Judith certainly has gone on and done a great career. And a lot of the other people in the band have kind of done different things. For me, it was like, you know, immediately I have to find some work. You know, I just kind of went back right to work and all that. And I even did a Michael Jackson tribute over in Japan and Korea. My first attempt, what I really wanted to do was, I was trying to do something with the This Is It band that was a tribute to Michael on my own. So I met with people that were able to come up with the money to do something we did in Japan and Korea. In 2010.
How did that go down? What was the audience like? Because it's kind of they're songs that you want to dance to and enjoy, but it's emotional for them, but they're fans of the artist. So it must have been a strange atmosphere.
It was strange. You know, it was, there were people that were like flying in, and people were giving me gifts and stuff like that because they, you know, they wanted me to tell them something about Michael and all this kind of stuff. That part was strange, but I was so wrapped up in like the business of it and getting the band there and dealing with the, you know, the people there on a business level, and just making sure, you know, it was hard.
Yeah, I bet. And
it was hard.
What's your thoughts on So do you know that they did a show, it was in America like a year or two ago, where like they had a hologram and stuff like that?
Yeah.
What's your views on that?
You know, it's kind of like, I feel like it's not really for me to say, more his family.
Yeah.
You know? So,
or any artist. Yeah. So let's not just talk about Michael Jackson, but like, say if you were to get a gig and it's, I don't know, Freddie Mercury on stage or someone like that, how would you feel? Like, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like one day.
Oh, it's definitely going to happen.
It's going to happen one day. You know.
It's already happening.
Yeah. As a kind of a stage left musician, how would you feel about that? It's a strange one, isn't it?
It's not, you know, I'm later in my career right now, so it's certainly not something I would be interested in doing if I didn't have to. But I'm not mad at anybody that feels like it's okay, especially if their family is all right with it, you know.
I think that's a good point. Get the family buy-in. Yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. So when I watched This Is It, and when there's kind of previous gigs that he's done over the years, there was always one or two songs. He sung live and he danced and that great stuff. But there was always one or two songs that I could tell he was miming. A lot of people could tell he was miming. It was the same, exactly the same vocal track from the record. If he was going to mime on This Is It tour, did you have to like sign disclaimers and stuff like that? Or was that something you ignored? Or because on This Is It, there's definitely vocals, I think, on Thriller and one or two others that are the ones from the record.
Mm. Well, you have to remember this, Chris. Like, you know, This Is It is a rehearsal for nobody. You know, so we're playing, literally playing high energy, you know, this kind of thing. And it's also, you know, it's like, it's basically a fly on the walls view of a rehearsal, of a major production rehearsal. So there's going to be times when Michael is going to be more concerned with choreography in a specific spot, or you know, this kind of thing, or he's going like 80% of what he can do, because he knows how he has to pace himself in order to do the show live, you know. So I would just say that, like, I think really anything like that has to do with This Is It was just a factor of we weren't really playing for the audience yet, you know.
Cool. And you've worked with some of, you know, talk about some of the people you worked with. There's so many we haven't even mentioned, actually, but we will come to. But you've worked with some of the most kind of powerful and high-profile musicians ever.
Sure.
What's their, collectively, thinking kind of holistically, collectively, what's their biggest weakness?
Well, you know, I don't even consider it a weakness, because I think as musicians and artists, we're like basically insecure beings in a certain way anyway.
Mm.
And that insecurity manifests itself in a lot of different ways. You know, I know with me, it's, you don't even want to know. I mean, like, I go through a lot that people don't even realize that I go through, because, you know, I just have to be that guy when it's time to hit the stage or rehearse or whatever. But the same thing with the artists. And they have a lot more on them, because they have, you know, reputations and, you know, everything else that goes with that. I just think that a lot of people don't regard them as like all the way human beings, but they actually are. And therefore, just that insecurity about whatever it is, you know, it could be anything. Sometimes that manifests itself in ways that you have to kind of like circumvent them, or kind of, you know, help them, be their cheerleader in a certain way, or be their counselor in a certain way, even, you know. And sometimes they have to do it with you too, you know. So I've been pretty lucky to work with just really great people too, you know. I'm very, very blessed, very lucky to have, you know, a whole 35-year career with really just cool people, you know, for the most part.
And as a musician who is, you know, synonymous with Michael Jackson, that link, and you talk about, like, you know, notoriety rising and that kind of thing, I have to ask, so from a purely music point of view, this is a music, you know, podcast, when you see things like the Leaving Neverland documentary and stuff like that, how does that affect you as a musician who's related to Michael Jackson's music and the link and that kind of thing? Do you worry about that from a brand point of view or marketing and stuff like that? It's a very delicate area for you, I
imagine. It's a very delicate area, but to me, I'm about the music, you know what I mean? And I mean, it'd be one thing if it was, without naming names, but somebody that was like maybe not just accused but also convicted of something, you know. We're talking about Michael Jackson. First of all, you know, it's inconsistent to the artist and person that I got to work with in my mind. And secondly, his music is just so incredible that's really what I focus on. I'm actually doing, interestingly enough, I'm doing a Michael Jackson musical tribute in a few weeks.
Oh yeah, nice.
And the venue actually came to me and told me that they did not want to advertise it as a Michael Jackson tribute.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a delicate, you know, this is nothing to do with you, but this is, you know, it's such a delicate situation as someone doing a business and running life as a musician. So how is that now? Is that going ahead or is it?
It's going ahead. It hasn't been, I mean, there may be a few surprised people at the venue, but as soon as I walk on stage, I'll be like, welcome to the Michael Jackson musical tribute, you know? And I have lost some, I do some work with actually an incredible impersonator. His name is William Hall. And I think we really do justice to, you know, a Michael Jackson experience, you know, with video and dancers and the whole thing. And I've been asked to do a lot of other ones in other countries, but I will say that since the documentary came out and all, I've actually lost some work because they got canceled, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, I can't say I don't understand that, and I understand how people could feel a certain way about, you know, his, the man. But the truth of it is, what I tell people is, he was acquitted in the United States, and he's passed on. So to me, there hasn't been anything to me that's like been definitive where it's like I really completely believe that at all. Not at all, you know.
Thank you for answering that so honestly. And when you, let's talk about when you're, you know, you, the most high profile shows you've done, all the high kind of pressured shows. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting you talked about, you know, what you played at the memorial there. How do you prepare yourself mentally to thrive in those situations? So I do a lot of work away from here, which is around kind of this phrase, kind of thriving, not surviving. So sometimes we have high pressure things, like to a mere mortal like myself, who never made it as a musician, it might be a job interview or presentation, something like that. Some of us go through that mental state of going, I just want to get this over. I want to get this through. But actually what we want to be doing is getting into the mental state of like, how can I thrive? This is an opportunity to show off what I can do. So really boiling down some of those really high pressure shows, like you did Oprah Winfrey's show, you did Bill Clinton's, like you played at the White House and stuff like
that. You played for two presidents,
right?
Which we'll get to. King of Morocco and some other kings.
So how, what are the kind of things you need to have in place mentally and maybe even physically in regards to your proximity to things that you need for you to thrive, to be at your very best for those performances?
Well, you know, it's a tough one for me, Chris, because, you know, I do deal with, believe it or not, stage fright and, you know, just my own insecurities musically, you know.
Syndrome? You heard about the imposter syndrome?
No, I'm not into
that. The imposter syndrome is basically like, I'm going to be found out. I don't know. I shouldn't be here. I'm not.
Okay, now I know what I have. Okay, I have imposter syndrome. Yes, absolutely.
But everybody gets it from the very kind of highest.
Absolutely. And then, you know, the more you're out here, now here I am in London, and, you know, certain people know my reputation and all, and they expect that, they expect you to be, you know, probably even a little bit... you know, more than you are sometimes, but, you know, certainly I have bad days and good days. So, it's to like show up, be on point, be on time, you know, be nice to people, play the parts, have all the, you know, have all my stuff together. If I'm a musical director, to be able to lead and all that. I mean, there's mentally preparing for that sometimes is really tough, but, I just push through it. I mean, I actually even forced myself to do concertos with orchestra, you know, like Rhapsody in Blue with orchestra, and you know, folk concertos or classical music concerts, which really takes me out of my comfort zone. And
to stretch myself and
push through even the fear of doing it. You know, it's kind of like it's my tightrope, so to speak, you know.
What's the worst case scenario that you're on stage? Is it a case of someone says, oh, can we play in a different key and you haven't learned in that key? Or would it be, what's the worst kind of thing?
Yeah, that would be hard. I mean, I have really good pitch and all that. So, but for me, like if I was playing Rhapsody in Blue with the orchestra and I screwed up somehow, there's no way to say, hey, can we go back and do that at the top? There's no one to blame. I can't point to another keyboard player and, you know, look at him funny like, what are you playing? Or someone, you know, it's you have full responsibility for that moment. Being a musical director for Bette Midler, who's very demanding but a perfectionist and, you know, very, very good at what she does. You know, sometimes I feel to myself, I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know, if she, you know, I feel like a little bit of a fraud because, you know, I don't know that I'm at that level of being able to like hit my marks every night and stuff, but I just push through it, make myself do it, you know, and I make mistakes.
Yeah.
And have to forgive myself for the mistakes, which has been, that's been one of the hardest things for me.
So often a lot of people talk about that. It's one way to do that is accept the fact that you will make mistakes and probably make less mistakes because you're not trying not to make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's one way you can go about it. But I mean, absolutely. The fact that, I mean, I cannot think of a more, if I was to think up like that most high pressured environment or situation than the situation you had at the memorial. You know, you're looking down, your hand shaking, you've got to play those notes, which you know off by heart, obviously very well. And then you've got, you know, the Jackson brothers, you know, taking out the coffin like this, and you thrive and you did it, man. You nailed it. And so, like, you can take confidence from that.
I did it.
That is such a difficult situation. I mean,
it's tough. I mean, I've also had a situation. I was actually telling somebody today about it where I made a mistake on an Earth, Wind & Fire show that was actually taped for television and all that. And it was a small little glitch. And 3 years later, somebody, an up-and-coming musician that I would happen to be on the same show with, came up and told me, yeah, I heard that mistake you made on Reasons, you know, back 3 years ago.
And really?
Yeah, I was kind of looking at him like, all right, thanks, you know, appreciate it.
What was the mistake? Bum note? Wrong note?
No, it was, it was a bum note. It was actually, I totally remember, because we were in the Caribbean and it was hot. My hands were sweating and I slipped on a note, on a pretty important lick in Reasons, with the song called Reasons. And I can't take it back. There's nothing I can do.
Reasons,
yeah.
I think that's when you joined Earth, Wind & Fire as the band's musical director. Had you been playing with them already?
No, I'd never been playing with them, and I didn't join as a musical director.
Oh, okay, right.
I got the musical director job the following year.
Following year, right, okay,
Yeah, it was a great time because it was a time that they were putting the band back together again. They'd kind of been, you know, not together for I don't know how many years now. They went out in 90, I think was their last tour. And I believe that Maurice White was kind of like, okay, well, that's going to be it, you know. And the way I hear it, Philip Bailey, the lead singer, and Verdine, bassist, who's actually my biggest musical influence.
I saw that, and I saw you did a TV show with the two of you doing kind of like bass solos with each other. Yeah, amazing. That's the dream, isn't it? If that's your bass hero and to do that, that's...
Literally the dream. Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to dream about that very thing.
Wow.
But but the two of them did it. I think Philip was doing a jazz festival because Philip has a lot of different sides. He's got jazz albums, he's got gospel, everything. So I think he was doing a jazz festival and Verdine came up and joined him.
Nice.
And the audience just went bananas, you know, and I think they did an Earth, Wind & Fire song or two. And they decided, you know, maybe we can take this back out again. And let's talk to Maurice and, you know, if he gives us permission, then we just go out there and see if people would be into it without him, Maurice, being in the band. And that's when I became the musical director, right at that transition. And Maurice did actually come and do more dates with us since, quite a few actually, and recordings. But that was an important step because that is actually the Earth, Wind & Fire that's still out there right now. What is it now? 2019.
Yeah,
so it's
wow.
15 years ago.
No, 25.
25. Oh, good lord.
Here's a question. So, listeners, kind of listening to this, when you visualize Earth, Wind & Fire, you think of kind of load of funk, loads of energy, smiley faces.
Yeah.
All those gigs that you would do when people are tired, you know, been traveling, that kind of thing. Where do you get that energy from? Like, is it down to the musical director to say, come on, like, the energy isn't quite right? Or does that naturally come through the music? Or
I take absolutely no credit in that other than just being part of the party. It's actually completely genuine. We love the music that much. We love each other that much. And when you got a guy like Verdine, that's, you know, to me, one of the greatest entertainers of all time, not just one of the greatest bassists. There's no way you're going to have a guy like that. We had Sonny Emery playing the drums. It was just amazing, you know, one of my closest friends. That energy is going to be there, and we know the end result of it. And the end result is it's infectious. People they'll go home changed some kind of way because it happened to me back in 1976 when I saw them. The feeling that I got from the band changed my life because then that's when I knew, my defining moment when I knew what I wanted to do in my career. Then I started doing my own bands in, you know, middle school and high school and all that. But we know that at the end of it, we'll feel like we won the World Cup or the Super Bowl or something. And that's exactly how it felt every night.
And I got to ask you about, so when you played at the White House, a state dinner that was hosted by Bill Clinton, and he invited you guys along to play. So tell us about that from beginning to end. I want to hear this. This sounds amazing.
Yeah, that was amazing because, you know, Bill Clinton was a very popular president then, Hillary, you know, all of them. And it was the largest, I think, to date, state dinner ever because it was the King of Morocco.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Was there to visit. So, and actually... we went on to play for the King of Morocco in Morocco.
Wow. Okay.
So that was another gig. With,
booked another gig. That's, you must have been impressed.
Yeah, which was amazing too. But yeah, so that we playing the White House, of course, was amazing. And I was really into Bill Clinton at the time. You know, I was
he's a sax player as well and all that.
Yeah,
kind of
he was a sax player. He's musician. Yeah. He was doing, he was having these big affairs, you know, at the White House that were like, you know, music was a really big part of them. Not every president was like that, you know. I think he and Obama were probably the presidents that were most into music.
Yeah.
I actually got to play for Obama as well. We did a tribute to Motown, so it was like Stevie Wonder and Mary Wilson, the Four Tops, and, you know, we're playing to them. And our musical director, Greg Fillinganes, who's, you know, great, one of the greatest keyboard players on earth, was the music director and invited me. And we had our special guests were Seal and Jamie Foxx and Jordan Sparks and you know, on Sheryl Crow and on and on. So it was an all star tribute. Actually, that's on video as well.
Wow.
To Motown.
Yeah, where was that? Was that
at the White House?
That was White House.
Yeah,
you played the White
under
House twice.
Obama. Yeah, twice.
So what's it like going into the White House? I mean, the security must be crazy. So do they? Do you have to do like weeks before? Do you have to do like security checks and stuff like
you
that?
You know something? They just do it.
Really?
Yeah, because you know they know who you are.
Okay,
you know,
right.
So you know
they've checked you out already.
Oh, for sure. Before you can even walk in there, they know exactly who you are and everything you've done.
Yeah.
And so you know, basically, it's not all that as extensive as you think it would be. You know, all that work is done beforehand.
Let's get it on. Let's go. This is dedicated from the president to Michelle.
Played a gig to who's been in the audience that's most kind of got in your head. So it might be a family member or something like that, but straight away you think, oh, it's got to be the president, that, you know, that's the, you know, that is that person looking at me, you know, how they're enjoying it.
Yeah.
But it might not be the president. So who's the person that's most kind of got in your head you thought, oh, this person's in tonight?
God, well, this, wow, so many things come to mind, Chris. I mean, you know, when I was doing Janet Jackson's tour, she brought along Jimmy Jam from, you know, who wrote all the songs.
Oh, wow.
Produced. He was like kind of her, you know, show producer kind of thing. So if he was really loving the show, so he'd be out in the audience every night. So here I'm playing his music to him. That's memorable. I've done shows with Donald Trump, was in the audience quite a few times.
Really?
Yeah. Not that I care. But
and I'm sure he didn't either.
he didn't either. But in general, it's going to be a musician. Stevie Wonder has been in the audience. I've played with Stevie a few times. But
have you?
Yeah, Stevie's come to a lot of gigs that I was on where he just kind of unannounced, like, wow, you know. And then I've done like a lot of star-studded audience type things, you know. So, you know, you're looking at all of Hollywood in the audience and stuff. There's Denzel Washington and there's, you know, everybody you can think of. So I really, to me, those things don't affect me that much. What will affect me more is if I know that, like, you know, there's like a musician that I really, really dig, it's in the audience, and that, you know, sometimes I don't even want to know until it's over.
Until it's over,
you know,
yeah,
and then I'm like, okay, that's great. But if I knew beforehand that some, you know, incredible keyboard player was out there, it might really mess in my head, you know. So
yeah, playing keyboards and knowing that Stevie Wonder's in the audience.
Yeah,
that's got to mess with your mind a little bit. And what, so you play pretty much, I've seen videos you playing pretty much every instrument that exists. Pretty much. So here's a question. What skills are you currently developing?
Currently still, you know, still the instruments, you know. I'm really trying to get trumpet up to a level of, you know, really you know, killing it, you know. So, I'm also developing, you know, I'm 57 years old now, so things for me now, I'm doing a lot of songwriting, you know, I'm trying to do things that are, you know, money makers, but mm-hmm. I don't have to, like, you know, carry my keyboard, set them up, play mm-hmm. a gig, 4-hour gig, tear them down, this kind of thing. So I'm doing a lot of mailbox money type of things that we say. I'm really trying to develop my career as a songwriter right now.
Because you had a song that was in Three Men and a Lady.
Yes, I did.
Lady, is that right? Yeah, yeah. So that was one of your ones. And so do the checks still come through with that?
They do. And I've had a few more. I've had the Spike Lee movie.
Really?
Yeah, Earth, Wind & Fire did a song called Cruisin', and that's been in a movie. I've had about 3 or 4 movie songs, which are great. I've had one gold album that I can claim where I wrote, but I wrote about 6 of the songs.
Nice.
And that was in the day of a gold album was really 500 copies were actually sold, you know, this kind of thing. No streaming and all that. There was a guy named Najee who's a saxophonist. And we won, you know, some awards like Soul Train Best Jazz.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
It was cool. We were up against Take 6 and Anita Baker that year.
Wow.
So I was just to watch it on television going like, yeah, we're not going to win. But, you know, just to even be in the category. And then we won.
Wow,
you know?
Cool.
There's been stuff like that that's been very rewarding, you know.
Out of all the gigs and concerts and shows you've played, what is the one that you wish you'd been in the audience for?
Wow. Great question, Chris. I would have loved to see myself play Rhapsody in Blue with orchestra. It was my dad before he died. It was like one of the last things he saw me do.
Oh, no.
And like going back to one of your earlier questions, he really saw me as someone that would be like more studied, you know, musical conductor or you know, concert pianist, this kind of thing, you know, and I used to play violin and, you know, so I was getting pushed more in that direction, like quote unquote serious music, mm-hmm. you know. So it was a great thing before he died to see me, you know, put on the coat and tails and sit down and get a standing ovation for doing a, you know, full length classical concerto with orchestra.
You made your dad proud, man. Well done. That's great. And, as a bassist, have you ever snapped a string?
Oh, yeah.
It's lethal, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've not only G strings, but D strings.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I'm very physical with the bass.
When you have written hundreds of songs and bass lines before, what is the creative space or the creative well, if you like, that you go to when you've got a blank sheet of paper in front of you?
It's going to always be, go back to the bass players of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's always going to be James Jamison, Verdine, all the guys from all those 70s bands, which I love. I could name them all. You know, I used to, they were all my heroes. Chuck Rainey and, you know, everything that I'm going to play is going to come, Larry Graham, you know, is going to come from Jaco Pastorius. I've had the pleasure of actually, like, meeting all those people and actually working with them and even had a few lessons with Jaco, you know. So, like, it's going to be some combination of all that mixed into some kind of, you know, whatever, paella or something. That's me, you know. Yeah. But I think Verdine is definitely my biggest influence. And there's always going to be some kind of something that makes you. Matter of fact, this is a funny story. We both, Verdine and I, did an album called, Urban Nights 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like one of those kind of like all-star albums. So it had Jonathan Butler and Ramsey Lewis and Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire produced it and all that. And I played bass on half of it and Verdine played bass on half of it. And we were out on Earth, Wind & Fire listening to it for the first time, just the two of us on the bus. And one of the songs came on that I was playing and Verdine looked at me and he goes, "This is me, right?" I said, "No, it's me."
Awesome.
Yeah, that was freeze that moment in time.
Imagine telling your 14-year-old self that.
Yeah.
What's the most important piece of music memorabilia you own, or an item or something that you've got that you've kept from a gig or anywhere that you know, if the house is burning down, your instruments and family were looked after, what's the most important thing that you've got?
Probably my dad's guitar. Yeah, the guitar that my dad... It's actually a nylon string classical guitar. My dad just wanted to play guitar, so he learned a few chords and he could sing along and all that kind of stuff. But it's actually exactly how I learned the bass on the classical Yeah.
Wow.
Because it would be like my cousins would come over and they'd be playing the guitar player. I'd be the bass player. So the bottom four strings of that guitar was my bass. So when I actually had a real bass in my hand, I already knew how to play it.
Wow. Yeah. Right. That makes sense. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best bit of advice you've been given?
Wow. That's a good one. Don't take it too seriously. You know, I think bet on yourself. You know, I think that anyone's best foot forward or their best chances for anything is to be themselves. You know, be yourself.
And is that the advice you'd give someone else, or is there any more really specific advice you'd say to someone?
I say be yourself, follow your dream. That simple.
And then end up playing bass and with all the greatest players ever.
It works.
What's the biggest setback in your career, and how did you approach overcoming it?
Wow, these are great questions, Chris. The biggest setback in my career, I think it had to do with like forgiving myself for mistakes and just beating myself, self-criticism, and I think I just adopted it. A kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Something that to where basically the way I look at music now is in a spiritual way of kind of like, why is music there and where, how does it happen? And I have to just kind of have this feeling of like, okay, in any situation, whatever was supposed to happen actually did happen, no matter what it was. You know, that was what the people were meant to hear. That was the right combination of people were there to make the music, and whatever came out of it and how it was recorded or performed, that was the way it was meant to be for that moment. And somehow that helps me forgive myself, because I just feel like I'm not trying to make something happen. I'm just part of something that's happening, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. You know? And actually, I mean, one thing, you might want to read it when you go away, if it's something you're still working on, but there's this thing called Aaron Beck's cognitive restructuring, which is this idea that we often, if we replay things that we've done in the past, like say gigs or performances, whatever it might be, we can tell a very negative narrative of what happened just based on one little mistake.
Sure.
And it kind of eats us away and we keep thinking about it a lot. And actually what's the thing to do in that situation is to look at the objective data and go, so what did other people think? And most people will go, I didn't even notice it, or it was great, and
absolutely
that kind of thing. And we can
true.
Beat ourselves up about those kind of things. And it's called cognitive restructuring. It's really interesting. But
I will check that out. I love that.
The human condition is that we really focus on that negative bit, and then we have this narrative that we go round and round and round, and we just need the objective data, what other people think, to get that actual reality and that balanced view of how things went.
It's so true, Chris, because a lot of times I'll say that there's when I feel like I flubbed the show, and it's like, okay, let me just forget that one. That's when I get an email from somebody saying, that show really changed my life, or
exactly.
It's always something like that.
So listen to that more than the inner voice. It's kind of the thing around that. Who are the best or most underrated stage left session musicians that we should kind of give some credit to?
God, I wish I had an hour to just list them.
The top three.
Underrated. Okay. Let's see. Good. That's a great, great question. Wow. And it's even a harder question now because with the internet and with social media now, there's, I'm getting turned on to musicians that I wouldn't normally know who they were. Like, I think Mono Neon is just incredible. There's on and on and on. But there's, wow, that's a really good question. That are out there right now still doing it.
Yeah. Who deserve a shout out that, maybe, because a lot of, session musicians.
My friend Sam Sims is one of the best bass players in the world. And he's played with everybody in the world. But he's such a, he's the kind of guy that probably, is rarely on social media, he's a bassist from Atlanta, I saw a lot of people in Atlanta that were like, incredible. But they're not in LA or they're not in New York or this kind of thing, so they may not get the notoriety. He's definitely one of them, I would say. There are many. I'll tell you what, if I think of any other ones, I'll come back to it.
No worries, that's fine. So You know, you've done a, you mentioned earlier you do a few masterclasses and stuff like that, and you like kind of passing your wisdom on if you can.
Yeah.
What bad habits do you have as a musician, technically, that you advise young musicians not to do?
Oh, God, so many. So many. Well, you know, my piano technique is not great because I didn't do my scales, you know, and I didn't do my Hannon and Czerny exercises and all that. So I'll slide on notes, you know, like I'll, instead of like playing, using two fingers to play two notes, I'll slide from one to the other. But I'm so used to doing it that it just kind of became part of my technique, even in classical. On the bass, I'm just horrible because I'm self-taught. You know, my technique isn't great. I do play upright bass as well. But somebody, I see a lot of the, I was just talking today about bass players who have like really great technique and their hand hardly moves and they go to the notes that are like right under their fingers and all that. Whereas mine is a lot more...
Sliding up and
down.
Yeah,
slide up and down. Or, you know, I like the way that note sounds on the E string better than A string, so I'll use that one instead. Or, you know, just gets a little bit haphazard, but you know, so is Viridian Whites, and he's like to me the greatest, you know, of all time. So I don't think there's necessarily technique is everything, but I think it definitely will help, you know, gives you a leg up. You know, it's better to have technique than not to have it.
How, if you look back at, you know, being 14 and seeing Earth, Wind & Fire, now kind of fast forwarding onto where we are now, how does that success in the music industry in reality compared to what you thought it would look like?
Good question. You know, the thing about it, Chris, I was always concentrated on the work, so I never really thought of it as like, wow, I'm really successful because I play with whoever, you know. Me, I was like, okay, I'm a working musician. And you know, the thing about it was, even when I was playing with Earth, Wind & Fire, I was still playing with, you know, Rochelle Farrell or, you know, whoever, Maxwell or Diane Reeves, Natalie Cole, you know, this kind of stuff.
Wow.
I was just always, you know, if Earth, Wind & Fire had 3 months off or something, boom, I'm doing a Natalie Cole tour or, you know, Roberta Flack or this kind of thing. I actually had musician friends that would get mad at me because they thought I was hogging up the work because not only was I taking other gigs, but I was doing them on different instruments, you know. So I'm still a hustler. I've always been a hustler. And I've actually probably more of a hustler now than I used to be. So I've never had that, like, sit back on my laurels and, you know, like, yes, I was Michael Jackson's keyboardist kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's never been like that. The business has changed so much now, too, that even with the accolades, you still got to hustle, you know. So, yeah, I mean, to me, I'm just doing what I've always been doing and still hoping for success.
And that brings us on to the Moog Pleasure Band. Is that the name of the band you're going to? Yeah, nice one. So what you got coming up? So what can we look forward to?
Yeah, oh, God, so many things. I mean, I'm so proud of my band. I've got Luke Smith on keyboards, Mike Brown, a guitarist. I've had a few lead singers, Ivy Chanel, Kedma, it's been one of my lead singers. I've got Josh McKenzie and sometimes Mark Mondesir on the drums and Tuca Milan on the percussion and all that, Jamie Michael Harris, saxophone, or Dan Reinstein sometimes. And they're just incredible musicians. And I've been now 4 years, like, working with some of the same ones, you know. And so it's gelled into this really cool family, you know. So, and we all read each other's minds, you know, so, which is amazing. So I just can't wait to get on the stage. I like having, like, a certain amount of structure and a certain... like I kind of like Miles Davis approach to it. So even though we may be playing even the same songs, they might go in a whole different direction.
Right, nice. You know?
So
never playing the same song the same way twice.
I hope not. You know, and I try, what I'll do is I'll be the one that kind of throws the wrench in the works. When everybody thinks everything's going the way it normally does, I'll be like, break it down, bop. And then I'll say, you know, percussion solo here. You know,
wow.
So now we just got to deal with it. How do we get out of it? I don't know. Let's figure it out, you know. and I'm very much a band guy. So even in my own band, I'm never trying, you know, I'm musical direct for so many people. When my band, I almost completely stay out of it.
Oh.
Other than.
And does someone else do it?
Well, we all do it.
We all do it.
You all do it. So it's kind of like if the idea comes from the keyboards, let's go with that.
Go with it.
You know what I mean? So,
And what's coming with Bette Midler? So are you going on tour or?
Oh, I sure hope so, Chris. Right now, she teases us every now and then and says we're going to go back on tour. The last tour was 2015, and we ended up with two nights at the O2.
Wow.
Yeah, which was great. I remember it was like, it was right near my birthday in July. We ended up.
She finally got to play the O2 at least.
Yeah. No, that was kind of cool. Yeah. I didn't realize I had a handprint of Michael there too.
Do they? Yeah. Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Right. Wow.
So, that was, so I'm hoping she does. She, you know, she's very, very capable of doing it. She still sings great and she dances and all that and tells jokes. She's amazing, you know.
And a question we ask, the final question we ask everybody on the Stage Left podcast is, what fears do you have for the music industry and how might those fears be addressed?
Wow, I have so many. I fear that that the actual music part of the music industry gets lost in so many other things, you know, whether that be not just business, but fashion, video, and all this kind of, and you know, internet and all that kind of stuff, that maybe we're concentrating on the wrong things sometimes, and that actual talent, actual really good songs, and those kind of things are actually being ignored in a certain way, and that we're going to find ourselves in the future looking back still. September will still be on the radio, you know, or be people will know Earth, Wind & Fire is forever. But I think that we might look back at some of this time period as like, especially for pop music, is what I'm saying, because certainly there's a lot of great music out there right now by young people, that we may be looking at it as kind of like, wow, that was a moment, that was a time period that we kind of were...
Took the eye off the ball.
We took our eye off the ball. Like, you know, the lyrics weren't really about anything, or, you know, the melodies were kind of, you know, two notes, which isn't always a bad thing.
Interesting you say that, because a friend of mine said that if, you know, would Prince have turned out to be as great a guitarist if he had to dedicate so much of his time updating his Instagram page?
Right. And I find it's weird for me because, you know, now here I am at this age, and that's a really, the social media part of my life is important.
And it's exhausting, and it takes up time and resource, which you are then taking away from doing the creative bit.
It is. I'm too busy doing it to, like, really report on what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Luckily, there's a lot of people that are around me that, like, you know, take pictures and videos and help me out with my social media. But I just think that, like, you know, and I'm so much the opposite. I'm actually more, I think, more of an introvert than an extrovert. Like, I have no desire to tell anybody, hey, here I am eating a hamburger in Berlin or something. I don't really care. But these things are important, you know, so it's become a different industry. It's just,
so how do we, what needs to change?
I think we really need to concentrate on what stirs the heart. You know, I think we need to concentrate on, you know, what is it in music that really gives you those goosebumps, you know, as opposed to, like, you know, well, so-and-so had hits, so let's make it like that, you know. Like, I get a lot of that. Hey, can you kind of make it sound kind of like, you know, something that's really popular? And then the next thing that's popular, hey, can you make it, you know. So we're kind of like, to me, I think we're kind of chasing, you know, our tails a little bit, you know, whereas, like, instead of, like, digging really deep and trying to come up with something that's truthful and from the heart, that will stir other people, that stir their hearts.
Thank you so much for appearing on the Stage Left podcast, Mo. You've lived the dream of every young musician who's listening to this. Thank you for your wisdom, your insight and candor. And we've loved chatting, and best of luck with the upcoming shows. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed myself. It was great.
Can you remember the guitar part that you said on acoustic for Black and White?
Oh, you're going to be ready for this? It's chicka-chun.
Is that it?
America.
Really? Chicka-chun. Nice.
Yeah,
one.
It's like that simple.
Okay,
there's like maybe one other part. And that's it.
Cool. Okay, thanks for being such a great guest.
Pleasure, Chris.
Cheers.
Thank you.
It's been good. What a joy that was for that interview. Genuinely, I was kind of sitting there thinking this is one of the best episodes ever of the Stage Left podcast. All killer, no filler. What honesty and insight, really, about what it was like working on the This Is It tour. Mo is going to do one of our Stage Death Nights supper clubs. So you may know that we are very lucky that we, you know, my partner is an award-winning chef, does this amazing food. Go on our website, there's a page on there about it. Mo will be playing in our lounge in London, if you're London-based or UK-based, and he'll be playing a set for just eight other people whilst we all have amazing food, and he joins in for the food as well. So, that's going to be coming up soon. We're going to be working out some dates for that. So thank you to Mo for doing this. It's been a very special episode, and we'll see you next time.